I'm Rajeev Lalwani. I cover aerospace and defense here at Morgan Stanley. I'm excited to have Greg Hayes, the CEO of United Technologies, up here. Greg's gonna come up and make some prepared remarks, I think, for about five or 10 minutes, go through some slides, and then I'll join him up there to do some Q&A, and we'll try to get you guys involved as well. Greg, come on up.
Thanks, Rajeev. Morning, everyone. Just as a precaution here, of course, we've got the. You guys wanna read through that for about 10 minutes, and I'll keep going. Just a quick warning, there is, of course, forward-looking statements here, and actual results may differ. In addition, in connection with the proposed Rockwell Collins acquisition, UTC has filed a registration statement that includes a prospectus for UTC and Collins, which is effective and contains important information about UTC, Rockwell Collins, yada, yada. Anyways, so that's out of the way. Let's just switch to UTC, and you guys know the company, right? This is. There's nothing new here. Four great industry-leading global franchises, all with great growth trajectories, all with solid, solid backlog. Think about the aerospace business, about $30 billion, and this is before we close on Collins. Again, you've got Aerospace Systems and Pratt & Whitney today, a little over $30 billion. With the acquisition of Rockwell Collins, that'll be about a $50 billion business in 2020. So a huge aerospace business. And of course, solid businesses in the commercial building space. Otis Elevator, the world's number one elevator manufacturer. Revenue is a little over $12 billion. And of course, there's the climate controls and security business, the Carrier business, with about $18 billion in sales. Again, all market leaders. And I think more importantly, all positioned to grow, not just this year, but for years to come. And no change here, right? We've talked about this. I've been CEO for just about 4 years now, and the priorities remain the same. The first, of course, is focused on execution, and that is meeting our commitments to shareowners, meeting our commitments to customers, meeting our employee commitments to all of our stakeholders. We're gonna continue to innovate for growth. We're gonna spend $2.5 billion this year on R&D. We're gonna keep spending $2.5 billion-$3 billion when we get Rockwell Collins. The key is you have to stay ahead of the game on innovation, and I think UTC has a track record of doing that. And we're gonna invest no matter what the cycle looks like. We're gonna continue to invest because that's how we're going to continue to grow. Structural cost reduction, you'll hear more about this as we get towards the end of the year, but we've continued to look for ways to take out cost. And again, one of the hallmarks of UTC is margin excellence, and the way you maintain margin excellence is through continued process improvements in the factories. That's about lean manufacturing, and it's about continually focused on taking out cost, doing more with less. And I think that's just something you will see on and on. And last, disciplined capital allocation. Someone might have questioned me a year ago about disciplined capital allocation when we spent $30 billion to buy Rockwell Collins. I would tell you today, the deal looks a heck of a lot better than it did 12 months ago, and I think it'll look even better once we get it closed and once we start the integration process. We've got at least $500 million of cost synergies already identified. The team is ready to go. I think Kelly Ortberg, who will lead the combined Collins Aerospace business, and Dave Gitlin, who'll be the Chief Operating Officer, have done a tremendous job in preparing the Collins and Aerospace Systems business of UTC to hit the ground running as soon as we close. The question is, when are we gonna close? If you would have asked me 3 months ago, I would have said almost any day. The fact is, it has taken us a little bit longer. We still expect to close before the end of this month, which I think is about 2 weeks from today. There's still a little work to do, although I think we have answered all the questions from all the regulatory agencies. I'll tell you, in all candor, the reason that we are where we are is we had a problem with one of the business divestitures. It's just taken us longer to find a buyer for one of the businesses that Rockwell has. That's behind us now. That is Safran. You'll see that they made an announcement a couple of weeks ago buying that business. But it's taken a little bit longer than I would have liked. We still expect, again, to be closed here shortly and hit the ground running with those cost synergies. Of course, what that does for us is give us tailwind into next year, and I'll just spend just a minute here. I've been giving this little chart of pluses and minuses for the following year. We always come out here to beautiful Dana Point to talk about what the next year is gonna look like. I think someone sarcastically wrote, "This is the UTC earnings takedown season." That is not my intention today. In fact, I would tell you for the first time in a number of years, if you look at this chart, there's actually more positives than there are negatives. And leading the list, of course, is organic growth. And we'll continue to see very, very solid organic growth next year. You think about the Pratt backlog alone, they've sold over 10,000 GTF engines. And we'll ship almost 800 engines this year, over 1,000 engines next year. You're going to see solid organic growth there. We continue to see solid aftermarket growth as RPMs, revenue passenger miles, continue to go or to grow in the aerospace side. Of course, we're going to get accretion from Collins next year. We've talked about that already. As we looked at the plans the other day, that's a solid plan for next year. Commercial aftermarket we talked about. And the military, we haven't talked a lot about the military, but as you know, the budgets have been going up and our spending's gone up, and we have a preeminent position in the military aerospace, and Collins just adds to that. On the challenges, you can tell Akhil Johri put this together because he wants me to talk about the effective tax rate. He's our CFO. This year, the tax rate, we think, is about 24.5. Akhil tells me next year it'll be 25.5 because of some change in the BEAT regulations. They're going from a 5% transitionary rate to a 10%. The point is, we're still working on it, but it's something we're going to need to keep in mind. Tariffs, who knows? This year, we said $50 million or so in tariff headwinds for the back half of the year. Should those tariffs continue, that's probably double that number for the full year next year. But I would tell you, that is just a big question mark. I saw we're not going to have tariffs. We are going to have tariffs. Everybody's got the same headwinds. So I think, you know, we'll figure that out as we go. And FX, again, the year started out, the dollar was weakening versus the currencies. It's since strengthened. I think next year you could have a little bit of first half headwind with FX, but it's early. And again, as I looked this morning, the European and the other currencies continue to strengthen against the dollar. In terms of, you know, kind of the big question marks, no surprise, geopolitical environment. What's going to happen? Are we going to have a global trade war? I don't think that's in anybody's best interests. And then pricing, productivity, and input costs. And this is a concern I have. It's primarily a U.S.-based issue, although we see a little bit of cost headwind in Europe, especially around logistics. UTC spends over $1 billion in logistics costs annually. So it costs to ship our products either into the factories or to our customers. We have seen significant pressure on logistics costs this year, especially at the carrier business. We saw it at the end of the second quarter where we couldn't get enough trucks in to deliver air conditioning units at the end of June. That has not abated. And I think this whole issue around the trucking shortage in the U.S. is something that is not going to solve itself in the near term, just given the shortage of truckers available. In other input costs, we've seen some headwind on commodities. Not a big deal this year beyond the tariffs. We typically have those things locked in 6 to 12 months. But we're always a little bit worried as you start to see inflation kick up. But, again, something that we're going to have to manage. On the productivity front, we have seen some calls for labor increases beyond what we have seen the last 5 years, especially in Europe as the economy has started to recover. We've seen some very, very hefty increases proposed by some of the trade unions in Europe. Again, things that we need to work through, things that we need to figure out how we're going to offset those, but that's what you guys pay us to do every day. So with that, that's a little brief look at 19. How are we going to go about the business? Again, our focus is how do you create value for shareowners on a long-term basis? And it's pretty simple, right? We've got these great industry-leading franchises, global reach, global scale, and we're going to continue to invest. We've got innovative products. At CCS, just the climate controls business, over 200 new products in the last 2 years because of the money we've invested in R&D. We've got a great business model. More than 40% of our business comes from the aftermarket services. I would tell you we have a strong performance culture. We meet our numbers every quarter, every year, and we're going to remain disciplined in capital allocation. You saw earlier this year we sold one business, Taylor. It's a great little business, but we found a better owner. We're going to continue to look for opportunities on the portfolio side to streamline the portfolio, and that's even in absence of any bigger portfolio move that we'll be looking at here. So let me stop there. That's my 10 minutes, and Rajiv, what's on everybody's mind?
Why don't we both relax and have a seat?
Oh, have a seat. Oh, sure.
Yeah. No need to make you stand for another 30 minutes. So, Greg, there's obviously a lot to cover out there. So let's start with sort of strategic direction, right? That certainly is something on our mind, your mind, investors' minds. Can you talk about just some of the work that you've been able to do, that the board's been able to do in terms of evaluating the direction of UTX longer term, while you're waiting for the Rockwell deal to close?
Yeah, Rajiv, it's actually been about a year now since I think we've told investors that we would be evaluating our strategic options once we closed on Rockwell Collins. I would tell you that we haven't been waiting for the close of Rockwell to do the work, and we have continued over the last 12 months to do analysis around what it would look like to potentially split up UTC. We've looked at various options, whether it's you split aerospace commercial, whether you split aerospace and the two commercial businesses. I would tell you that work is nearing completion, and I would expect within the next 60 days or so, we'll have an answer for all of our investors. We've certainly talked to all of the investors to try and get input from them. Probably not a surprise for most of you in the room, although I could ask you guys what you want us to do. What we have heard is that the people prefer focus, and our investor base, even though they appreciate the benefits of UTC and the ability to weather big economic storms as part of a large multinational, investors tend to value focused companies, and we have, I think, some great, great businesses. I think the best thing as we've gone through this analysis with the board is, as we sit here today, we don't have to do anything. We've got great businesses. We've got great growth prospects. The question that the board has to answer, that we have to answer, is what is the best way to create additional long-term shareholder value? And is that through these focused businesses or together as UTC? And again, not to presuppose an answer, but we're working on it, and I think, again, within 60 days here, we'll have something for everybody.
Yeah, as we've been asking you about, it was very dynamic over the last year or so. Something that you've highlighted as an obstacle to doing it is just costs associated with tax and just given the various entities and stand-up costs for new businesses. But that number seems to be coming down over time. Just some thoughts there on how material that is and how much of an obstacle it really is, based on all the evaluation to date.
We have done a tremendous amount of work in the last year on that question, and I would tell you the biggest cost associated with trying to pull UTC apart is the tax cost. We have about 1,200 legal entities around the world, and to pull these legal entities apart, because our business in the Far East owns pieces of Otis and pieces of Carrier and pieces of Pratt, you end up paying taxes in local jurisdictions. That's going to be a big damn number, and I think big damn number, it's probably going to be $2.5 billion-$3 billion. At the end of the day, you know, it's while it's a big number, in the context of a $100 billion market cap, it's not that big. And in the context of what we think the value creation from standalone businesses is, I think it's manageable. So the tax cost is big. There's one-time costs for advisors, you know, bankers and lawyers and accountants and all that. The other cost, I think the other thing that we need that we've been focused on is what is it going to take in terms of additional overhead costs to run three separate businesses? And I think, you know, we came out with a number 6 months ago of about $350 million of additional incremental costs. The biggest piece of that incremental cost, not surprisingly, is standing up an IT system in each of the businesses. You know, today, UTC has a single IT infrastructure for all of UTC. We'll have to replicate that. That's going to be expensive. At the same time, as we've looked at this and we've looked at other companies that have been spun, what we see is they work down those costs over time. And so while, again, $350 million of headwind is a big number, you know, if you capitalize that number, it's you know, $3 billion-$4 billion. Again, we think you can overcome most of that over time just through doing things more efficiently. And just to give you an example, we have 140 people in our tax department at UTC. We have 26 different server farms around the world that we use. If you're going to set up a standalone company, you're not going to stand up a big tax department. You're not going to stand up a big IT infrastructure. You're going to use the cloud. You're going to use outsourcing. You'll find ways to do things more efficiently. So we're working through those things. I think you know, that won't be the impediment, I think, at the end of the day to how we decide to pursue or what we decide to do strategically with the portfolio.
Is it unfair to say that there are other ways to explore offsetting some of those costs? I mean, you know, things like M&A, selling assets, so on and so forth. I mean, you know, you read what all of us put out in terms of HVAC consolidation and so on. You know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, I would tell you, we've been pretty popular since we've been talking about this. I've gotten a lot of inbound calls from a lot of people about opportunities for consolidation, not just in HVAC, but in really all of the businesses. And if you think about it, if you have a focused Otis elevator business or a focused climate business or a focused aerospace business, the M&A aperture is very different. Because all of a sudden, if you're focused just on aerospace, there are some things that you might do that you wouldn't do as a multinational. And if you're an elevator business, there are things that you might do as expensive as they might be, but if you've got a currency that's based on elevator multiples, different than what you might do standalone. So I would tell you, all of those things are on the table. And when we talk about portfolio optionality, I can't tell you what UTC will look like 18 months from now. I would tell you, we're going to explore every single option that's out there and what's the best way to create value. And I think, obviously, some combinations on the commercial side where you can get some big cost synergies is very attractive. The downside, of course, is antitrust. And you've got to overcome, whether it's in the elevator business or in the HVAC business, you know, the big players, there's not that many of us. And so I think that's the dynamic that you always have to keep in mind. These deals, while they seem attractive, there is some risk associated with them.
That's helpful, Greg. Thank you. Let's switch gears a bit. You made a comment about closing the Rockwell transaction here in, I guess, the coming weeks. You didn't mention in your prepared remarks concerns around China. I think that's something that I'm certainly concerned with, investors are. How do you get comfortable with that side of it?
Well, I think, you know, the process, the regulatory process in China has gone as well as we could have expected. I think what has typically happened here is the Chinese will not give us final approval until the DOJ signs off. And so right now we're waiting for DOJ sign-off, which we expect, I'll say, shortly. And then I would tell you, we do not see any issues. We've answered all the questions of the Chinese authorities. They have not given us any indication that there is any issue other than DOJ final approval. So as I think about this sequentially, I don't see an issue getting this done by the end of the month. And so far, I think you saw it the other day in the paper, the Wall Street, the Chinese have not penalized the multinationals over some of these tariff threats and some of these other trade threats that have come out of Washington. So I think they understand that the, you know, free trade is good for China, and the investments that we bring to China are also good for the Chinese economy. So far, you know, I don't see any real concerns at all there.
In terms of, you mentioned earlier, you know, some divestitures. Can you just talk broadly about the impact of selling some of the smaller businesses to get the deal done, some of the concessions with the likes of the Boeings of the world? You know, what impact is that having? Are those numbers within what you were planning when you announced the deal?
Yeah, I think, you know, in terms of the divestitures, we knew there were three businesses where there was some level of overlap that we had to dispose of. Again, these are tiny businesses in the scale of, or the scope of what is a combined Collins Aerospace, which is about $26 billion. So, you know, the businesses have been divested now. I think the issue has always been, how long does it take once you divest to actually transition to the new owner? And that's what's taken us so long with the DOJ here, is actually trying to make sure that, you know, these businesses, as we stand them up and as we sell them, are viable. But I think, you know, there's been no surprise there at all. I'm sorry, what was the other part of the?
Yeah, just in terms of the concession.
Oh, the concession. You know, we've talked about this. I think Dave Gitlin mentioned it back in our investor conference earlier this year. At the end of the day, our work with both the OEMs and the airline customers did not result in any significant concessions. We have a deal with Boeing on PFS2, and broadly speaking, it's NPV neutral. We gave some things, they gave some things, they gave us some additional content, we gave them some price concessions. It works the same with Airbus. We're working with them on that same kind of trade. But at the end of the day, again, this was all in line or better than what we had assumed a year ago when we signed the deal.
And maybe a last question on Collins, and I'll turn it over to the audience to see if they have a question or two. How has the underlying business been performing relative to, say, a year ago. I mean, from my perspective, it seems like it's gotten better in places like biz jet and defense, but I'd love your perspective, if it's better, worse, or about in line.
I think, you know, if you think specifically about the Collins business, I would tell you the base avionics business, the defense business, has done better than what we had forecast a year ago. Where we have seen some concern is in the interiors business. This is the legacy BE business. They're a little bit, I think, no, not surprisingly, behind plan. They've seen some deferrals, especially out of the Middle East, on some of these wide-body aircraft, which is a very profitable segment for them. So that, you know, as we've talked to the Collins folks, it's a concern, but not a long term. I think, again, if you believe what's you're going to continue to see, 30,000 new aircraft in the next 20 years, they're going to need seats. And, I think, BE Aerospace is uniquely positioned as the leader there to deliver. And so the little bumps that we've seen this year are not really a concern for us long term.
With that, let's pause and see if we've got any questions in the audience. There's one right up here.
I guess I'm just trying to understand how you could I'm trying to understand how you can have a chart that shows your challenges that doesn't have fixing GTF as number one on the list. I mean, it's like the elephant in the room, and you didn't even talk about it. So.
Well, I would tell you, when you talk about fixing GTF, I'm not sure if you're talking about production deliveries on GTF. I think
I'm not talking about orders. I'm talking about making the engines work in the marketplace for carriers.
Yeah, so look, I think we have had, as we have told you, I think three problems with the engine since its inception, or since it went into service 3 years ago. I would tell you those issues, be it the combustor life, we've got a solution out there. It takes us about 2 years to actually campaign the entire fleet to implement the new combustor design into the fleet. We had a liftoff seal, same issue that was design issue that we had early on. We've seen that. It's caused a lot of removals. But the removal forecast that we had 6 months ago is exactly what we have experienced. So while there have been challenges there, I would tell you the airlines have been relatively patient with us because we can tell them when they're going to have their removals. We've got lots of spare engines out there, and we're doing the best to minimize disruptions. Having said that, there are a number of AOG aircraft out there, about 10 today as we speak. I think, the team at Pratt has done a pretty good job. We had another issue earlier this year we talked about with a knife edge seal, where we had opened up a clearance to try and solve one problem and created another. Again, we've campaigned the fleet for that. There's lots of noise with these engines. I would tell you, though, there was an issue we heard from Lufthansa that there was a vibration issue on the engine. Now, this is an issue that affected a very small number. We understand what the issue is. You're talking about 2% of the fleet. So when I think about the issues with GTF, reliability, we're at 99.89% reliability. That's pretty good for an engine at this level of maturity. We've got about 800,000 hours on it. Once we approach 1 million hours, I think we'll have found all the problems. I would tell you the bigger issue that we didn't really talk about is, getting cost out of the GTF. We've got the delivery on pace. We'll do 800-plus engines or so this year. We'll do more next year. The challenge on GTF is coming down the learning curve. And so far, we've got this 87% learning curve. We're coming down it, but it's a challenge. There is about 1,100 highly engineered parts on an engine, 8,000 total, 1,100 highly engineered. We have a cost reduction plan for at least 500 of those today. So, again, the technical issues that are out there, they're well understood. They've been well communicated. There's no real surprises. And there's always going to be issues. We continue to see issues today on the PW4000, on the 2000, and the V2500. It's not unusual in these engines. But I would tell you, that's the technical side is not my concern today. It's cost more than anything. And again, people are focused on it, but there's a hell of a lot of work to do.
Thanks, Greg. We've got one more question here, and then we'll get back to our Q&A.
About what you're trying to do to circumvent that, and is it just taking more price to get to the front of the queue? And you said it's not going away soon, so what are your strategies there?
So, what we have done, of course, to get product out the door is you pay premiums to the freight forwarders so that you do get to the front of the line. We have national logistics supply contracts with a number of the big players in the industry, but everybody's suffering right now. And it was especially acute in July when you're trying to ship thousands and thousands of air conditioners a day. We won't probably have that problem again as the market slows down in the back half of the year due to seasonality, but it's something that we're keeping our eye on as we think about next year. I'm not going to stand up my own trucking company, as interesting as that may seem, because that's not what our expertise is. So we're going to rely on the logistics providers to find solutions for us. In the meantime, I think it's higher cost. It takes 2 to 3 years to train a truck driver, and people don't want to go be truck drivers in this country. And I think that's the root cause of what the problem is. So pay is going to go up. We know costs are going to go up for those logistics, and then we're going to have to look for alternatives, be that rail versus truck, or some other opportunities, just to get fuller loads instead of half loads. But they're working through a lot of those different challenges today.
Greg, I wanted to come back to the GTF. Can you talk about a bit more about the recent issue around the vibrations? Has your team been able to take a close look at it and get comfortable that that's not going to be like any of the three issues we saw before?
Yeah, so I think there have been about 10 engines out there that have suffered a vibration issue. There are vibration limits on the engine. This is a situation where we have censored the engine to tell us when vibrations exceed a certain limit. And when that happens in flight, a notification goes to the pilots. It's not a safety of flight issue. It's simply a warning that, we have to service the engine. We've identified what the issue is on a couple of these engines. We're still doing some testing, but it's not we think maybe in total there's 15 or 20 of these engines out there that may exhibit this because of an assembly issue. But again, we think this is not a big campaign to fleet like the combustor liner. That was a big deal. The liftoff seal, that was a big deal.
Maybe a higher level question for you on the GTF. There's clearly a debate out there as to whether or not the program is worth anything. Some people may even believe it's negative. What is it that you think folks, we can laugh about it, but what is it that folks are missing?
Well, I think, so here's the problem with the GTF. We've invested $10 billion, right? And it will generate about $750 billion of revenue over its life. Unfortunately, we'll never get to break even on the OE side, even when we get to 10,000 engines, right? We'll still be losing money, just like we do on the V2500 today. So if you think about that, every time you ship an engine, right, you're sending a check out of over $1 million for the cost of that engine in excess of what you're getting in terms of revenue. You don't start seeing the aftermarket for 5 or 6 years. And so the engines that we shipped in 16, 17, and 18, there's no revenue. There's no additional revenue, right? But come 2021, you'll start to see revenue pick up in the aftermarket. You'll go through the first overhaul cycle. And the first overhaul cycle is typically not a heavy overhaul, but the margins are such that it typically offsets the negative engine margin when you originally shipped it. You don't actually start seeing the bigger margin benefit until you get to the second one, the heavy overhaul, where you replace life-limited parts. And that's going to happen somewhere, call it 10 to 12 years after we've shipped those engines. So, as we look at it from a time value of money standpoint, it's a good return. But if you're planning horizons the next 3 years, it's not a great investment. And I think that's why, as we think about these aerospace investments, when you have 25-year time horizon on these investments, you got to be damn sure that you know what you're doing here. And while there have been obviously issues on the front end, those pale in comparison to the aftermarket margins that you're going to get. But we got to get the engines out there. We got to get them to a reliability level where we're making money on the aftermarket. But I think it's simply a question of time horizon.
Switching gears a little bit. Very topical within aerospace is the headwinds amongst the supply chain. Can you talk about how your suppliers are performing and your ability to get the engines out to the various aircraft OEMs?
So I think we have done, I talked about 8,000 parts, 1,100 highly engineered parts. We have visibility into our supply chain such that we can see for each one of those parts what is the yield of the parts as they come through these suppliers' factories? What is the timing? There's probably a handful of parts today that we would tell you are problematic. They're late. Either yields are down or there've been some other production snafu with the supply somewhere in the supply chain. I won't name names. It's the usual suspects. I think you can read the paper. You can figure it out. But there's at these volume levels, it's difficult. I think all of the big supply chain operators are suffering from the same thing. That is, there is excess demand that nobody really anticipated 5 years ago. And when it takes 4 or 5 years to bring on capacity, it's a problem. It's even in our own factory, we've got a plant down in Columbus, Georgia, where we do isothermal forgings. And this is, you operate these presses at 2,000 degrees F under about 200,000 pounds of pressure to make turbine disks. Well, we've got four of these presses down there. We've just got the fifth online. We need a sixth. It'll be four more years before that number six is actually online. So it takes time for the supply chain capacity to catch up, and I think that's what we're seeing today.
Maybe a last question on the aerospace side for you before I pivot away. We've seen Boeing make a handful of announcements, seating, APUs, and so on. Seems like they're coming after you in a way, but I'd love to get your perspective on how concerned you are about some of those capabilities that the large OEMs are adding.
So I think this is a constant debate between the big OEMs is what do they do in-house versus what do they do in the supply chain. I would tell you that the answer to that for us is to continue to invest in innovation where they have to come to us because we've got the best, most innovative products. And whether it's out on the electric system side or I think we've got a significant technological lead, whether it's on engines, even APUs, I think, we have a long history in these businesses. We know the technology. We know how to build them. And, Boeing and Airbus may decide they want to get into the nacelle business. We've heard that. We think we can do it at a cost basis that they can't possibly approach just because we've been doing it for 50 years. But, again, for us, the way to stay ahead of this is to continue to spend money on innovation, to continue to drive costs down, and to show them that the value proposition is better with us than to do it themselves. Boeing had talked about avionics and standing up an avionics business. That would take a long time. To replicate what Rockwell Collins has today at the Boeing level would take years and years and lots of investment. And I just think, Rockwell Collins will stay ahead of them because they've got a long history, and we're going to continue to invest R&D dollars.
Let's move over and talk, Otis, two topics in particular. One, the obvious one around China and new equipment. Are we seeing that inflection you've been talking about for a while? And the second is just on the European side as it relates to services and the growth there.
So if I take a look at the last 6 months in China, I would tell you orders have turned the corner. But they turned the corner primarily on the infrastructure side. So we're seeing higher dollar value orders out of Otis, fewer units. We have not yet seen the recovery in the residential marketplace in China that we had been anticipated. But dollars and margin dollars look to actually be improving here, and I think that trend will have continued through the third quarter here. But the Chinese market, the days of 20% growth year after year, probably not going to happen. I think we've talked about overbuilding in China, over-leverage. Now, those things are real. At the same time, the economy is still growing at 6.5% or so a year, and the government still is making investments in infrastructure, and there's a lot to do. We've been very successful there. Europe, I guess it's a good news story, I would tell you, on the OEM side in terms of new equipment. We've been very successful there. We've turned the corner in many markets. We've seen share improve. We've seen pricing stabilize in the services side, and particularly on the repair side of the Otis business, which is about a third of their aftermarket. We're not seeing pricing traction yet in Europe, so that will continue to be a headwind for us, I think, or at least an area where we're not going to see growth or much growth. And that's, again, our biggest service market. Of the 2 million elevators we service worldwide, 1.1 million are in Europe. So as Europe goes in the aftermarket, so goes the Otis aftermarket.
Okay. We only got a few more minutes. I wanted to make sure I hit on CCS and HVAC. Can you just talk about how the resi market is doing, how the summer went overall?
Really, really good. This is one of those situations where, you know, there's almost a dichotomy globally, where so the U.S. economy is so good, and we have seen such strength in the U.S. residential business at Carrier. You wonder, you know, what's going on in the rest of the world. The rest of the world, we're seeing growth, but nothing like what we're seeing in the U.S. So this is, again, some of this is catch up from years of, I would say, less than replacement market levels. So we have seen a little bit of a catch up, but we're also, you know, the market remains robust, not just for Carrier, but I think the whole industry you've seen has had a very, very good year, and hot weather helps. It continued, at least as I saw it, through the end of August. Orders were very, very good on the res side. And the res, that's really the only place we're still in the res business. Most everything else is done through joint ventures, be it in Europe, the Middle East, or even in China.
Okay. Maybe a last question or two for you. Can you talk a little bit more about the cost headwinds? You mentioned the logistics side earlier, but just, you know, give us a little bit more about, you know, tariffs, raw materials, and maybe even labor and so on, as we look into next year.
Yeah, as I mentioned, you know, tariffs this year is about a $50 million headwind. That's really a back half of the year issue. You could double that for next year if nothing changes. So there's $100 million, so $50 million of additional headwind. The bigger concern, I think, is you've seen copper. It's moved around a bit. You know, you've got it blocked most, you know, pretty much for the first 9 months, but there'll probably be some headwind on the raw material side. Where we have not yet seen pressure is on the labor side. Again, it's 2% or 3% kind of labor inflation generally across the supply chain and in our own factories, and those are relatively manageable. The other cost inputs that we have seen from the second and third tier supply chain, there is a little bit of pressure there. We have passed almost all of that on. I think there have been three price increases this year at Carrier to compensate for these costs. And so far, those price increases seem to be sticking. So again, it's a robust market. There is some pricing power out there to offset the cost headwinds, which is something we don't often see.
And a last question for you. So, you know, you talked about the puts and takes around 2019. We talked about some of the cost headwinds. But when you pull it all together, is next year more about margin stabilization and maybe an opportunity to start taking margins up? Or are we looking for maybe a deceleration, if you will?
I think what you're going to see next year is again, solid organic growth. You know, this year you're going to see 5% to 6% across the portfolio, which is haven't seen in a very long time. You're going to continue to see solid organic growth on the aerospace side. That's in the backlog today. And we think both CCS and Otis, again, will see solid organic growth. Not the same level that we're seeing on the aerospace side, but, you know, probably in that 3% to 4% range. Margins have to improve. I think, you know, that was one of the things. You know, margins have flattened out at CCS, and they've gone down at Otis. They've gone down at Otis for two reasons. One is China. Not surprising, and the other, of course, has been Europe's service. We have to turn those around, and the way we're going to do that is by taking cost out. That'll continue to be a focus for both of the commercial businesses.
Okay. We are pretty much up on time. Greg, thank you.
Thank you very much, Rajiv. Appreciate it.